This is Uncouth Ruth, and you're listening to Cave of Solitude.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I'm your host, Eric Anthony, and if this is your first time visiting the Cave, we welcome you. Thank you for downloading the episode, and if you're a returning fan or fangirl of the Cave of Solitude, what's going on? Now, as we've mentioned in our previous episodes, our recent episodes actually, the clock to Fan Expo is quickly counting down. We're only a few short weeks away, and we figure, what better way to get into the mood than by dropping episodes that will help build the anticipation and excitement for the event. It is the biggest con that is in Canada. It's one of the top three conventions in all of North America, so this is a big deal. And we've recently had some guests on the show who will be at Fan Expo, whether it's Jason Fabok or the coordinator of the comics aspect of the Fan Expo, Kevin Boyd, who was on recently giving us some real insider information of how a con is set up and run. But this week, returning to the Cave is our local boy, the uncouth one himself, Mike Ruth. Now, lately, myself and Martin Slam Duncan have locked down some fantastic guests. Like, some guys are bucket list guests that we have, and there's more to come. But I gotta say, if I could have Mike Ruth on every week, I would totally do it. Whether he's a guest or a co-host, this guy needs to have a podcast of his own. He's so engaging and fun to talk to. I can hang out with him all day, every day, talking comics and fanboy stuff, whatever you want to call it, wrestling. And that's kind of what we did with this episode. It's myself and Mr. Slam Duncan. We took a trip out to Mike's stomping grounds and just hung out with Mike as he was finishing up some variant covers for the Aftershock comics that he's working on. I think it was Baby Teeth, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, it was Baby Teeth for sure. I remember that cover vividly. It was quite frightening. But as we were hanging out, we're hanging out by the Oakville Harbor and just being outside. It was a sunny, beautiful day. And as the conversation progressed, we were just hanging out together, and we figured, you know what? We brought our recorders with us. Let's pull them out. Let's document the moment. Let's record something for the fans, because this would probably make a great episode, which it did. And it was just fantastic. It's one of my favorite episodes that we've done because there wasn't a real structure to it. There wasn't any specific topics that we were trying to cover or questions that we needed to ask. It was just all natural and honest, and it felt like what it was, just a bunch of buddies hanging out, talking comics, wrestling, etc. And believe me, if you are a wrestling fan, especially a classic wrestling fan from back in the days, you're gonna love this episode because Mike drops some gems on us, referring to matches that were hard to find, but you can see them now on YouTube. Just great matches of little wrestling history and tidbits that I didn't even know about. So it's great. We had a blast. I'm sure you will too. If you are coming to Fan Expo, remember, go visit Mike at his table. I don't know exactly the location of it yet, but you will be able to find it as the weeks progress, and you'll have a map and a layout of the con floor and artist alley. He is easily the most intimidating looking guy that may be there, but definitely the nicest guy. And I know I say that about a lot of our guests. I said that about Jason Fabok as well, and it's true, he really is. But Mike is right up there. Definitely go to his table, chit chat with the dude, you'll have a blast. And if you are going to be at Fan Expo, and if you do go see Mike, make sure you get a commission from Mike, because it will be the best money that you spend at this convention, I guarantee it. So without further ado, this is Eric Anthony. You're going to hear Mr. Martin Slam Duncan from the Fastball Special, and our boy, the uncouth one himself, Mike Ruth. Enjoy, everybody.
Is it Rick Jones? I got the sense that it was Rick Jones that passed it. Which, you know, so, killing Rick Jones is just stupid to me. Like, he's like, but again, you know, like I said, I feel like such a stranger in the Marvel Universe now.
I know what you're talking about, yeah. I know.
I feel like such a stranger in the Marvel Universe, and a place that used to give me such comfort and solace is now a place of confusion and anger for me. And that's not a, that's just not what my recreation ought to be. I have a blood pressure issue, man. I'd rather relax when I read my comics. I would rather be relaxed and happy when I read my comics, not made into a rage. I remember on my, I think it was my 38th birthday, I was at the beach. Maybe we talked about this last time. I was at the beach with my wife at Rock Point Beach, and issue 600 of Hulk came out. And issue 600 was a forced bullshit number 600, which they showed how they justified it, and it was just this assembled number because they wanted to sell a big issue 600 of the Hulk. And they were going to finally reveal who the identity of the Red Hulk. And right. I've been reading it for a couple of years going, man, this is, I hope this is going somewhere because I'm getting tired and pissed off at what they're doing with my Hulk. And then they reveal it to be Thunderbolt Ross. And I legit took that comic and I whipped it into the lake. I whipped it into Lake Erie. I'm sorry, Lake Erie. I will pay the fine. I will pay the park fine for littering. I have never been so angry in my life that I actually physically responded to a comic book by throwing it into a lake. So, I mean, I guess it can be said that I take some of that stuff seriously, but this is like stuff that, you know, goes back now a couple years and everyone just accepts that Thunderbolt Ross is the Hulk. No explanation for where the bloody mustache goes, though. I guess that's how they thought they were going to fool us, you know. It was the stupidest storyline of all time, and it's something that's unforgivable. It made me...
I think so,
yeah. The artwork was superb, as always, but fuck, man. That just pissed me off. That was just so retarded. Or, sorry, I can't use that word anymore. It was just a really bad thing that happened to comics, I think. And yeah. So that was the last time I bought a Hulk comic. And that made me really sad, too, because I've been collecting the Hulk since, I think, 1981. So I have a massive run of the Hulk that's going all through the 80s and 90s. And then it comes to that fake issue 600, which I actually wish was a fake issue. I wish I could actually say that it didn't exist, but it does.
Is that the one with Spider-Man on the cover, John Romita cover?
The Hulk one?
Yeah.
I don't know. Remember. I think it was just a Red Hulk on the cover. I can't remember. I kind of hit this rage point where I think I actually lost. I actually blacked out from pure rage. But no. I hope they do something. I hope Marvel can spin it around and do something with what they're, you know, with the properties that they still have and try to maintain some of the. I don't know. Some of the things that I used to like about Marvel Comics. I mean, I can't reconcile a Marvel Universe that doesn't have the Fantastic Four in it. I'm sorry. I'm glad that the Thing is getting kind of like this noir detective role within the Iron Man comics and all mm-hmm. these different appearances he's making there. I'm glad the Thing is still around. And he's really the only thing I really cared about with Marvel.
He's in space now, isn't he?
I think he was with the Guardians. Yeah. I think now they're doing this thing where he kind of shows up as this counterpoint to Doctor Doom, who's a pretty big character now in the Iron Man comics. So
he is Iron Man, isn't he?
Or something like that. It's like a Again, I'm a stranger in Marvel Universe. I don't even know anymore.
He's Iron Man.
That's why I like Squirrel Girl so much, because Squirrel Girl is such a fun comic, and her only knowledge of the Marvel Universe is based on a deck of cards that Deadpool has, Deadpool's like understanding of the Marvel Universe. So she encounters a villain like, you know, like Kraven the Hunter or something like that. It'll be Kraven's, the only information she has about Kraven is what Deadpool wrote down on these little cards. So it's really funny. It's really kind of funny stuff, and really enjoyable comic, yeah. Cool. But I think I like it because it has that purity of just fun and lightness. I just remember a time when it felt like the writers at Marvel Comics all were on the same page and all were aware of what was happening in other people's comics. So you'd have situations where, you know, you want to put a character in space that doesn't make sense. Well, you'd explain why. They would give a reason why. There'd be some kind of, you know, everyone was on the same page, it kind of felt like. But it doesn't, I don't know if it feels like that anymore, because I'm not reading enough titles to really care or know. But anyway, yeah, blah, blah, blah. There's lots of great comics out there. Lots of great alternatives.
As Eric was mentioning, we were speaking with Matt Kent, and what we found kind of interesting is he brought up a great question around the numbering, you know, the renumbering, rebooting, blah, 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 right? And people are getting a little upset about it, but it's a little different on the side of Valiant Comics, because on their side, they do it around the story, right? So what Matt Kent was saying is that whereas the marketing team, say on the Big Two, for example, we're going to pick on the Big Two for a little bit, but it's about the marketing. And then the story has to fit into whatever they want to market that summer or whatever event they want to do.
Yeah.
Whereas on the Valiant side, it's the story first, mm-hmm. and then they market build to the story.
Yeah.
Right? Which makes sense.
And hopefully that stays the same, though, that they don't get too big.
Right.
No, the Valiant's a perfect size, man. And I think, you know, I mean, it's like the Valiant universe, the Aftershock universe. I'm not sure how much crossover there is with the Aftershock universe from book to book. Probably not much. Right. But I think they've just got some great alternatives there as well. And then, yeah, the Valiant stuff, I mean, God, it's so good. This new Exo stuff is just so friggin' good. Like, it's just... I'm sorry, man. The artwork is superb. The story is great. I love the relationship that that Eric has with the armor now. Yeah, like it's awesome. this abusive love hate thing that's going on. It's magnificent. It's great.
Well, yeah. I mean, Matt pretty much said he's a huge Conan fan.
Oh yeah,
and he said he snuck his Conan story into this.
Yeah. Well, that's for sure.
I think I got cut out when I asked that question. He drew Conan, and now you're kind of giving Exo or Eric like a Conan-esque story, right? Mm. Where he's having to do all this without
the armor. First.
Dude, Exo's right. Conan in space. It's always been Conan in space, and that's what's so beautiful about it. I mean, that's marvelous stuff. That's great.
Do you think if the continuity, though, grows to the point where... these guys lay down tracks the way they've kind of done with Marvel, where it's like, well, you can't do that because, you know, this writer back in the 1980s established this, so you can't bring it. Make sure you bring it back to this point. Do you know what I mean?
I don't think they do it. I think they're so in touch. Like, I don't know your thoughts, but I think they're so in touch with the fan.
Yeah.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
I just hope it doesn't become something like that, where, oh, we got a Bloodshot movie now, so make sure you get Bloodshot back to square one when the movie comes out, because that's what happens with all the movies, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're such great stories. I mean, I think when you take any comic and want to take it to film, you have to consider, do we tell an origin story? Do we tell do we have to establish some kind of ground zero with what we're doing in this universe? Like, I think, you know, I think the stuff they've done with Bloodshot's been really amazing. I mean, I haven't read a lot of it, but the visual aspect of it has been gorgeous just as a sort of sideline observer. It looks marvelous. And, I hope anything they do on television will be great, and Bloodshot's one of those things that will totally work. Like, you know, absolutely. But it's so hard. Like, when you have characters that have these established histories, where do you go? What part of the story do you tell? I mean, how would you do a Swamp Thing television show? I mean, where would you start? How do you do it? Like,
I'd watch that.
You know, yeah, for
if
sure.
It's done well.
Like, but do you go back to the Len Wein stuff? Like, to the original kind of basic horror story aspect of it? Do you go, do you dare set foot up upon the Alan Moore stuff? I mean, it's all these things, right? Things to consider.
Are you a continuity guy?
In what regard? Like,
if you see, say, a particular character mm-hmm. on a monthly, mm-hmm. and they're in another monthly, same sort of era timeline, in one location, and then all of a sudden they appear in another location because the story lends itself to that. Is this something that... people have very polarizing views on
this. Well, I mean, for me, I think characters are what drives me. The stories are told by so many different people and different, you know, who want different outcomes. I think it comes down to the character for me, and I like watching characters evolve. Like, I've watched Sabretooth go from being his original kind of list, this kind of like shiftless kind of thug guy that showed up in Iron Fist, and then later he evolved into what was basically kind of a mindless monster, an unwanted mutant, where you sort of had pity for him. Right. And then they tie him into his history with Wolverine in the mid-80s, and all of a sudden you've got issue like 212 and 213 of Wolverine and of X-Men, where Wolverine and Sabretooth are tearing each other apart, and it's just the most magnificent stuff because they're just hinting at this other life. And
wait for that Harley to drive away.
That's all right.
Extra sound effect.
Yeah,
it's,
I mean,
all good.
I love watching characters grow. I love that you can, you know, there was that Bart Sears story of Sabretooth years ago, or the Mark Texiera one years ago, where they show a different dimension of the character, where he's not just this bad guy mutant. Like, he's not just the counter to Wolverine. He's actually got some personality and some depth there. And I think that I like that, and I like that to remain continuous. When I think about continuity, like, going back a few years, I remember when Shocker was part of the Thunderbolts team.
Right, yeah.
And I loved it because, you know, like the whole concept of Thunderbolts, like the, you know, that Suicide Squad-esque idea of, you know, bad guys working for a pardon for the government, doing good. And you know, and you have Shocker in that comic, the classic Spidey villain, and he's doing good things and he saves the day in this one story, and he kind of has this moment of going, you know, this is kind of cool. Like, I'm getting praise for my work. I'm using my abilities for good.
Right.
This is a strange feeling, and I'm getting my pardon as well. And then you have a story where there's this big blow up, and he escapes. He's not found, and they assume that he's dead, or they assume that he's gotten away, because, you know. But he's a character on the cusp of, like, do I go back to villainy? Do I go back to this? But it didn't matter, because the following month or so, they did that Spider Island story that crossed. That was a big Marvel event, I guess, with all everyone had spider powers, and there's Shocker showing up as a bad guy robbing a bank or whatever, with six electric Shocker arms. Makes sense. And I think, man, I just saw some progress in the character.
Yeah.
And I know that they're just telling a different story, and that's just a great visual. Six-armed Shocker with six, you know, electric, you know, just an awesome visual. But, man, it distracts from the progress they made with that character, in my understanding of the character.
I'm with you. Yeah, I'm with you with that. I like the way you put that, because I'm the same way. I don't care. Like, I think it should be about the story, and if you need to do something different, it's with the story. But don't mess with the character. If there is a certain progression, like you're saying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people have relapses, right? Yeah. People have relapses, like an addict or an evil person. I guess maybe you tiptoe back into evil if you've had a taste of good. Right. I mean, they've done it. I mean, look at the Sandman. Sandman's a classic Spidey villain who, again, for a time was an Avenger. He actually turned it around and became an Avenger. But when they need a villain, and they need a Sandman-type villain, they just drop Sandman in there. It doesn't matter that he was an Avenger. It didn't matter that he earned the respect of guys like Captain America and other heroes to become, to ascend into a position like an Avenger. Sandman, that's crazy to me. Fucking bank robber, or whatever he was. And he's, you know, but here we are. So, I mean, you got to use the tools you're given, and if you're in a universe like Marvel Universe, I guess you got to use the tools that you have, and you got to give them back in a certain way. But I just feel like there's great progress that is made with characters, and then it just gets forgotten very easily. And it may not even be it's obviously not the writer's fault. It might just be a question of, oh, I like this character and I want to make him as a bad guy, and here I go, you know. So I don't know.
A lot of people criticize, like, on the same level what you're saying, people criticize someone like Dan Slott sometimes for they don't like what he's done with Spider-Man. Spider-Man shouldn't be rich. He's not Tony Stark. But I like the fact that we're getting something different, like a different... Sure. You're still getting Peter Parker, because I feel like he's got the character down, and it's still... He just happens to be, like, Dr. Octopus made him a doctor, Peter Parker a doctor, and he made him a billionaire. But Peter Parker's still not knowing what to do with the money. He still goofs up. He still has the Parker luck. But people are like, oh, no, Peter Parker always has to be this way. And I'm like, but don't you want to see the character do something different? Well, do you always want the Stan Lee version?
Yeah, I mean, he's got to get out of high school eventually, right? And I mean, I appreciate that. I like watching a character grow up, too. I mean, you know, because here at the end of the day, if you want to tell the stories of Peter Parker as a teenager and dealing with all those teenage stuff, then you just do it. You just tell a story. It doesn't have to be, you know, you make it separate from the continuity. You tell a story. I mean, my God, there used to be 4 or 5 Spider-Man titles when I was a kid. You know, you had Web of Spider-Man, which was pretty more serious stuff. You had Peter Parker Spectacular Spider-Man, which really had some serious stuff. When you think about, like, you think about the Sin Eater storyline and things like that, where they really, you know, did some different stuff. You know, there's some great stuff that came out of that. And you need a character like Spider-Man, you need 4 books to tell that story, you know, I think, in some cases, if you're going to tell such a huge... But I honestly, like, I'll be honest with you, I read the Dan Slott stuff where it was the Doc Ox Spidey, and I liked it, man. And you're talking about a guy who loves Spidey. Spidey was the first original thing for me, you know. Like, I'm a Spidey guy deep down. I like my classic Spidey for sure. But, man, it's like when Kraven killed Spidey. There was a moment there where we had to accept that Spidey was dead and Kraven was Spider-Man. And, you know, there was a little part of me that actually kind of dug the idea that if we're going this way now.
Right.
And I was young enough that I didn't know that Spidey was going to come back and that Spidey wasn't dead. I was along for the ride, man. They had me. And that's good comics, right?
That's the point.
So, I don't know. I don't mind these different takes on care. Like, Spidey's got to grow up, so he gets a chance as a millionaire. Well, so they have they've done the fall of the billionaire story before with Tony Stark, and they've done it with Ollie Queen, sure, and they've done it with Bruce Wayne, I'm sure. So I mean, why not just tell the story for a while and let's see what Spidey could do if he actually had the resources to be Bruce Wayne,
right?
You know, with his powers, what could he do?
Why not?
So why not? Exactly. Why not?
I hated when they erased the marriage because they're like Spider-Man can't be married. He's one of those guys who had. That ruins the character. I was like, why does it ruin the character? Finally, why don't you just kill the aunt that's 150 years old?
Yeah. A very good friend of mine has every single issue of Spider-Man. Every single one. It's the most spectacular collection of Spider-Man. Yeah, ASM. ASM and everything. Oh, everything. Wow. He's got everything. Wow. And I'm going to tell you something really crazy. He is a giant Spider-Man guy, but since they undid the wedding, since they you know, rebooted Spidey from the whole Mephisto thing, all that.
Right.
Since they did that, what was that called? One more day?
Yeah, one more day, and then it went into a brand new day arc.
So ever since that arc, my friend has continued to collect Spider-Man, but has not read a single word of Spider-Man since that story arc because he was so upset by it. He collects it for the sake of collecting, and he has the resources, and he wants to have an entire collection of Spider-Man, and he will. But he could not read another word after that because to him, up until that point, there's no break. There's no redo. There's no new origin. Right. It's just 1963 until 2000 and whatever it was.
Yeah, I love it.
And that's a long run, man. That's a super long run.
And I say to people, like, Spider-Man doesn't have the stories like a Batman where you say, oh, you got to read The Hush or The Death in the Family, but as a whole run, I feel like there isn't a character who has that library like he does.
No. Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, for sure. Like, it's I mean, even the FF had a reboot in the mid-90s, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it still just went back to the old original numbering and all that stuff anyway. But that's when I stopped collecting the first time, was I was so upset about that reboot.
Heroes Reborn.
Because I was an original FF. I've been collecting FF and Hulk and Thor and stuff since I was a little kid. You know, and I got the collection, the ridiculous 27 long boxes to prove it. But it's I've been reading since I was a little kid. And when some of these things you've been reading for a long time just stop being what they were, it's like, it just makes you realize there's a bigger world of bigger ideas, and the Marvel Universe isn't the only place to find the satisfaction I need from comics. Because I'm telling you, like, comic books like Headlopper give me everything I need in a comic book.
Yeah.
Everything I need. Fantastic art, fantastic storytelling, original content, just exciting stuff, you know? Really cool stuff.
I just read Animosity, actually. Eric picked me up. I loved it.
Oh, Animosity is fantastic.
Loved it.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It actually made me, like, I started looking at all the animals around me, and I'm like, jeez, if these guys did, like, they could really mess you up. Like, I'm looking at my dog, and I'm like, goodness, you're...
Conceptually accurate. Yeah.
They've been our earthly companions for, you know, our whole recorded history, right? So it stands to reason they know a little bit more about us than we might think. So, yeah, it's a great series, though. Marguerite Bennett's doing incredible things with that. It's been awesome. It's been just really, really cool to... You know, to read. It's a great story.
You guys aren't Rick and Morty fans by any chance, are you?
I like Rick and Morty, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it just reminded me there's a episode where their sort of family dog becomes, not sentient, but becomes intelligent. and brings in all the animals in the neighborhood, but it's so funny. The dog's name is Snowball, right? It's just a little fluff.
I think
ball.
I've seen that one,
And he creates this sort of mecha suit so that he could walk around and becomes the... It's very interesting.
That show cracks me up, man.
It's amazing.
Cracks me up. Yeah.
I went on a tear on that show when I first discovered it. But it's so dark.
Oh, yeah.
It's incredibly dark.
Yeah. It's not for kids.
No, it's not for kids at all. Not at all. It's kind of a take. I don't, Eric, if you haven't watched it, it's kind of a... It's a sci-fi take on sort of the Doc Brown, Marty type relationship. but it's alcoholic uncle.
Okay.
Who is an inventor, and it's also a little bit of Doctor Who, because they go time, space, anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah,
and their adventures, but it's...
it's super good.
Yeah, super good and super dark and not for kids.
Was a, he said Back to the Future was a big inspiration for it.
Oh, it's all over it. Yeah, yeah, for sure. No, it's great, man. It's a great... And I'm a super late late bloomer on that show. I think, you know... I mean, we're still waiting for season 3, I guess, to come, right?
So three's out now, or three's out, was, or it already started.
Or it started, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, yeah. It's
funny. No, it's definitely. It's I was super late coming to it, but it's a super cool show. Yeah, you'll like it. You'll dig it.
Yeah. But anyway, that kind of reminded me of that, because they did a send up of what would happen, but of course to the next level, and there are these cute little animals that get involved. Yeah. Very cool.
Very good stuff. Funny show. Yeah.
So if you guys had an opportunity to write or draw for Marvel or DC, right, would you prefer them to give you the call and say, we're restarting the universe, you're on the ground floor running, and you get to do it fresh? Would you prefer that as a creator with the character, or would you prefer to continue whatever is going on?
I think... for me, I would want to... Well, I mean, I don't even know what's going on anymore, so I don't know how I'd continue. I think I would probably want to go back to what I knew, what I remembered, and the things that I loved about it myself. But I think the problem with Marvel wanting to tell new stories is... And then they've blundered numerous times with their explanation of why things aren't going the way they had hoped. And you know, they said, oh, it's because, you know, DC's return policy for retailers. And other times they say, oh, it's because of the diversity angle. People don't want diversity. They just want the regular old Marvel comics and blah, blah, blah. You know, this kind of thing. I think if Marvel wants to tell new stories, they just got to make some new characters. I mean, I remember they had the New Universe in the 80s, which for what it wasn't, maybe it was ahead of its time, but it was some beautiful stuff that I read in the 80s from the New Universe. I really liked it.
Oh, the Universe?
The New Universe was DP7 was great. Star Brand was great. There was some really good stuff. And I just kind of felt like, I don't know, that's maybe what... I think if I was starting something from new, I'd want it to be all new characters. I think I'd want to just be able to... Because I would always be wanting to go back and do the things that I love. The things that I remember most, you know. Those old Hulk comics, those old Sal Buscema Hulk comics, and those old Jack Kirby FFs, and all the stuff that made me want to do this, you know. Made me want to draw. So... Yeah.
Sorry, I'm looking at your Conan for the first time.
Oh, yeah. No, that's it. Yeah.
So
I meant to do a video, video shot of all the great Conan drawings in that book, man. Because
the face is amazing.
Thank you.
Look at that. Sorry.
That's the
for
best
people
Conan.
That are listening. We're just having this conversation here. But it's Mike did a commission for me of Conan, and he knocked it out of the park. So I'm just looking at it for the first time here. So.
Well, I'm glad you like it. It's the best Conan I've ever done, I think. I've drawn Conan a lot. I think you have the first commission you ever got there from me was a Conan. So
yes, it was. Yes.
You know, that was fun. So no, man, Conan guys always get preferential treatment with me. They always get my best work.
There you go.
You know,
look at that. Love it.
No, that was fun. That book's insane. You got a Jeff Isherwood, you got a Joe Jusko, you got a Kerry Nord. You've got guys who actually drew Conan. Beautiful Ty Templeton in there. Beautiful Richard Pace. He's drawn Conan.
Yeah.
Like, that's the legit stuff. I got a pinup in Conan, and I've drawn Conan on a cover, but I haven't done any interior work. I'd love to do some more cover stuff for Conan for sure. That would be a dream. That would be amazing. Yeah, I'm really liking the new Conan series that's out. I don't know how long it's going to last or how long... Colin Bunn's gonna take that, or how long the journey's gonna go, but it's been really enjoyable.
What title? I haven't read any of it. Is it
Conan the Slayer?
The Slayer. Okay.
Yeah, it's. Yeah. Okay. I think it's Davila. I think I don't know if it's got the name right, but he's doing the art. It's pretty good. Covers are pretty cool. I love what's the guy's name again? Shoot, I can't think of his name. Tim, is it Tim Truman? Him and Tom Giorello did that Conan or King Conan or Conan the King from Dark Horse last year. That little 4-issue mini, it was incredible. I loved it. Five issue mini. Oh, it's an
when
Conan.
You're saying this, I know, because I know you're such a fan.
It's the best Conan I've read in a long time. It's called. It's probably been collected into a trade by now.
Yeah, I'll look it up.
Conan the King or King Conan, whatever Dark Horse is calling that version of Conan. But they draw this cool Thomas Giarello is just fantastic artist and one of my favorites currently drawing comics. He's doing Exo.
Yeah.
He's his Conan book was so awesome, and it was the bearded up, you know, bearded, white haired, scarred up. There was a point in time grimy. When I was reading was Headlopper, which is a white bearded swordsman. Then there was King Conan the same month. I think on the same day I got Ragnarok from Simonson.
Oh. Loved it.
King Conan with the white beard. Ragnarok's got the white hair. He's the white-haired undead Conan. The Draugr, Thor. The Draugr Thor. You amazing. Got this amazing version of Thor. It's my favorite. Currently, my favorite version of Thor for sure. And then there was, you know, there's Headlopper, and there's a couple other things. And all the stars of the book, they all had these white-haired bearded versions of their original.
Even King God Butcher, right? You had that old man Thor.
Yeah,
in
I
there
love
too.
That's I love that version of Thor. I love that version of Thor. Yeah. And the Assad rebate chart is just incredible.
Ragnarok. Thanks for that recommendation, because I again was one of those I started looking through it. It was it's a beautiful book to start with. I love the design.
Oh my
of
God,
that Thor!
It's so great.
Do you know he has no jaw.
Lower jaw. Yeah,
is that a part of mythology, or is that something?
No, this is not to my knowledge. This there is some story to that, but I mean, you know, we know that at the end of Ragnarok, Thor dies after he kills the Midgard serpent,
right?
And he takes 9 steps backwards and dies, or something like that, and that's it. So I don't know. This is just I'm not sure where the jaw went, but I think it's just a really cool feature of the character.
And it's just darkness, kind of from being down and.
I love it in this story, you know, when we first meet him, Thor is so old and so forgotten that he's just called the Stone God, because they don't even know what he was the god of before at first. Like, he's just this, like, ancient relic that's been asleep for, like, years and years and years after Ragnarok. So, yeah, super, super good book, man. I really love it. And it's Walter Simonson, you know, who's, like, you know, hands down the best Thor guy we've ever had.
I recommend it.
Sure. And there's another Simonson hardcover artist edition coming out. Those huge artist edition books.
Is it going to be Thor? Ragnarok?
It's the return of Better Ray Bill. It's that other stuff that Simonson did after that initial Thor run he did back when.
Okay.
It's like it's the return. So it's like the end of Asgard. It's like, I think it leads up to that whole, like, basically what the movie's going to be, I think, essentially, like, where you have...
So he did another run on Thor afterwards? I didn't know that.
Or it's towards the end of his long run on Thor. Yeah, I think it's 6 issues from the tail end of his run on Thor. So, I mean, it's really, really... But Better Ray Bill comes back.
And it's the oversized...
It's the oversized, the IDW ones.
I never know.
And those are marvelous. Those are marvelous. I know. I have about 6 of them now. And like, it's just... they're so incredible, because, like, you look at them and you're looking at the artwork, the size that it was drawn, and you know what's incredible about that is you're looking at a Walter Simonson, and you can see the little areas of whiteout or maybe little patches that he's made, but everything is on that fucking page. Everything is on that page. And then you look at a book like, you look at the John Byrne one, and I'm not saying this to take a shot at John Byrne, because John is incredible and the guy's work is like, he's among my favorites as well, but you look at the John Byrne hardcover, the FF stuff, and you realize that his process is so different than Simon's, or Simonson's, where you have this, you know, you have pages that are assembled of like photocopied, so like maybe John drew something really small and blew it up and then did like an ink over, but you see these pages which are, you can actually see the tape marks and you can actually see the yellowed, you know, the yellowed glue stuff where the patches used to be or whatever, different things that have happened, because these pages are assembled and then photographed and then made into comics. Whereas Walter Simonson stuff, it's just on the page. You can see if he made a mistake or made something too small and had to draw it bigger, you can see where the old drawing was. Like, there's beautiful, beautiful little gifs and little nuggets of information that another artist can pick up, other artists can see and appreciate. It's weird. There's been this weird thing lately where I'm having people commission me for stuff, but they'll also want to get the rough notes for the commission. They'll want the rough sketches, because sometimes I'll do 3 or 4 rough sketches. And I've been including them with the artwork typically, but I want to keep them now because there's actually a demand. There's a whole other market for people who love the original sketches, just the preliminary roughs. And I mean, my roughs are super loose and rough because I know that I'm going to be inking it. I know that the inking is where all the heavy lifting is.
Right.
So my pencils are really, really loose. So I've recently had a company contact me to do pencils for a poster that they want to have one of their artists ink and finish, and they want to just have me lay it out and do the pencils. But I don't know that I could do that, because my pencils like are for me. I know what I'm going to do with ink,
right?
But I can't project what another person's going to do with my lines, right? So
I'm trying to look up because I thought Bernie Wrightson was going to. There's going to be something coming out.
There is a Bernie book coming out.
Is it an art book?
I believe it's an art book. I believe it was to benefit Bernie's wife, Liz. Okay. I think. I don't know. I know that.
As far as I know,
I saw Yannick Paquette had posted a beautiful Swamp Thing piece. And you got bunnies all over this park, man. My wife and I love this park. We come here to count. We had a 7 bunny day yesterday. my wife has an almost heroic kind of worship of the animal, like rabbits. Rabbits and hawks are our kind of spirit animals. And we come here and we hang out with the rabbits, man. It sounds really weird, but rabbits to me are a great symbol. It's like seeing a rabbit or seeing a fox is like a fox will change your whole day. I know this probably sounds like some hippie shit, but if you see a fox,
if you see a fox and
you actually think about that fox, you think about what you were thinking about when you saw that fox, you think about what's going on in your life at that moment.
Yeah.
The fox is a trickster. The fox has some shit, man. He's got some knowledge of you. And I know this probably sounds crazy, but I can tell you times in my life when I have been on the brink of fear, the brink of doom, be it financial, be it health, be it whatever. And in that moment of not knowing what the next day will be, I'll see a fox, and there'll be something about that exchange, that look, that the I can't explain it, man.
I just think maybe I'm reading too many animal themed comics these days.
But there's a deep connection with animals that I don't think we're aware of, man. And like whenever we see something like a bald eagle, because you see them now, you see bald eagles now. It's amazing, they're back. Or you see like a great blue heron fly by. It changes my whole day. It changes my whole outlook on the day.
Well, they say that even for people who own dogs, like elderly people, one of the best things for their health is to own an animal.
Oh, absolutely.
It keeps their spirits up. It keeps them happy.
100%, man.
Companionship.
I can say that as a dog owner for sure.
100%. Well, yeah,
like, you go home and
I look at my dog, and sometimes she's just staring at me, and I don't know what it is that she's seeing. It's like she's peering through my soul.
Yeah, what do you think?
But they're just looking at you, and it's comforting to see this animal just kind of look at you with a look of love. I don't know if that's
you're their world in that moment.
Yeah.
Right? It kind of.
You don't experience that with people sometimes. At least that's what I like to think. I agree with you because it gives you that feeling. So I understand when you see a certain animal and you have an exchange with them, there's something about it.
Yeah.
We're meant to have it.
Yeah. If you just sit and think about it, Just think about what you're seeing, what's going on in your head. There's a reason why that animal made itself available to you. And it's not just because we're killing all of our green space and forcing all the animals into the cities, but there's a little bit of that too. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. Well, when Sue and I did that North American trip.
Yes.
We had a lot of those little moments where, again, you just time stops. You know, when we're on Lake Louise and just time just stops and you just sort of take in the moment, right? It's just, it refreshes you.
I brought presents for you guys.
Ah,
no, you're right.
Cool.
I don't know if you guys have copies of these. Maybe you got one from Carlos.
No.
I know Carlos is selling them. I brought
thank
you guys
you, man.
Some copies.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks. Oh, my pleasure, man. I got a few of them, and it's probably not the kind of thing I'm going to have for sale on my table. You know what I mean?
Right.
Just because of the content. I wish I had a gold pen. That would make this better, but silver will work.
The lead singer of Gwar, just again for people that are listening because they're not seeing this, it's the Gwar, what is it? Orgasmatron?
Gwar Orgasmageddon. It's a Matt Miner comic. Yeah, it's a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And it's going to be, it's out now. The first issue came out last week, I believe. I did a variant cover for Hip Hop Comics. And I got a few extra copies here, so I'm gonna make you guys each can have one of these.
Thank you.
Thanks, dude. This one actually has some blood splatter on it from another job, which that just comes for free, I guess. But free blood splatter on this one from another drawing.
I hope it's not those little spiders.
No. But yeah, this was fun, and I still have the original painting, the original cover art. Again, it's not the kind of thing I'm probably going to put in my shop.
Right,
but
right.
I'll put those over here.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And I gave you a T-shirt already, so I got something else for... I don't know if you have this. I'm going to give this to you for the purposes of review. I don't think that this is out yet, but I've had this in my possession for a couple of weeks now. And this is the Jimmy's Bastards #1.
Oh, wow.
So if my Aftershock people are listening to me right now...
It's come out.
It has come out. Oh, it has come out.
Yes,
okay.
It has come out. The comics come out. I know that.
Do you have it though?
I don't have this.
Oh, covered. But you have a
I do have one. I haven't read it yet.
Oh, okay, cool.
So I will be reading.
So I'll give you this then as a.
My reading has changed, so I have a hard time waiting. So I'm in the Netflix world.
Right? Oh yeah,
where I have to binge everything. So. I'm a trade waiter now.
Oh,
so
really? Yeah. You're killing comics with that, though.
Well, not. But I'll just buy twice because I'm an idiot. So I'll buy, you know, like the first couple or any nice covers that I like, or if there's something specifically around that, I'll buy that one. But when I'm reading it, I prefer to read it as a trade. Because,
no, I understand that, man. I understand that. Sometimes too with indie comics. I mean, not with anything I'm collecting right now, but there was a time when comics were just like. Ex Machina, Brian K. Vaughan, Tony Harris, so awesome, man. But I remember I read the first two or three trades when they were around. I can't remember what issue they were on, but I think they were around the fourth trade. So I read the first three trades. I binged them. I think I ate the books. I physically ate the books. They were so good.
Yeah.
And then I was caught up, and then I started collecting them monthly. But sometimes there was 4 and 5 months between issues because Tony wasn't able to keep up with it or whatever. But then the way he drew that book was so incredibly detailed. It didn't surprise me that it took him as long as it did to get each issue out. I mean, you know, it's one of those things, right?
I just find it in some cases it takes me out of the moment. It takes me out of the story if I have to wait that long.
Yeah, I totally get that, man. I totally
unless
get
I go
that.
Back and reread a little bit, I could do that. But sometimes I get really, for example, the Matt Kitt books, like the Department H.
Yeah.
It's a whodunit.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
So you go so nuts waiting.
So I'm in this claustrophobic mindset because we're 6 miles underwater. and I'm reading this book, and if I had to wait another month before the next one, it's to get back into that mindset is for me difficult, I guess.
I always read comics monthly, and I think I actually enjoy that monthly thrill. The problem is when you start reading so many books, you actually forget what's happening.
Yeah.
That's why I can't watch Netflix shows in the same way. I have to space out a Netflix show. So like Breaking Bad came to Netflix, because I didn't have cable TV I haven't had cable TV since like 2000. So when Netflix finally had that, I watched that, and I had to watch them. The most I would let myself watch was maybe two in a single evening, a single sitting, because I found that show to be so intense that it would stress me out to watch more than one at a time. I would get so into it that I'd just get mental about it, and so I had to break it up. And I've been watching House of Cards.
Yeah.
I just finished watching the third season, whatever the current one is. And again, I had to watch them one episode per day because, again, I find that kind of stuff just too, I don't know. It's really good television, so I find it, I don't want to binge it and then be like, oh. But then Daredevil, I was like, oh, here comes Daredevil season one. I can't wait. I'm going to sit and binge it. I didn't. I watched it. And actually, Daredevil took us a while to watch. Jessica Jones, same thing.
That one took me a little bit longer. Daredevil, I did. Like, those were weekend binges.
Yeah,
binges for me. 2 days.
I think Erica and I crushed the first 4 episodes or so of Jessica Jones, and then we kind of paced it out. But then we got to episode 10, and I was like, screw this show, man. And I watched the last 3 episodes with gritted teeth and a blind red rage of...
What was it that got you?
There's a part in episode 10 which completely throws the entire story off track in my understanding of how... Not in terms of how it compares to the comic book, because there was no comic book that I've ever read that compared to the show. But there's a scene where they make use of Kilgrave's powers in a way that doesn't make sense. And after that, they've spent 10 episodes establishing how his powers work, and then in one moment they just completely drop it. And maybe people didn't notice it, but I fixated on it. And then some dude online told me that I was a rivet counter, which is a derogatory term for people who, you know, it goes to model planes, people who build model planes. Right. And you'll have some guy like, well, you know, you only got 42 rivets on this wing and it's supposed to have 44 rivets. It's not the same thing when the show's own storytelling fails. So I after that, I watched it to finish it, but I don't even remember what happened in the last 3 episodes. I don't even care.
But you know what? It's interesting you say that because that's kind of who we are, right? We are, I think, people that really have attention to detail.
Oh, it's all in the details. It's all in the details, man. It's like in wrestling, too. It's those subtle little things that you see in a wrestling match where you know a thing's going to go a certain way. Not how the match is going to end, but how a move might get executed or how an exchange of moves might happen. You see a body language thing. You pick up the details.
I had a conversation with a guy. What he does for a living is he does these shadow boxes. Right, so someone will have, like, say it's a comic shadow box or a concert, he would have the pics from the thing or the concert tickets and put etc. in. And he did one for one of his in-laws, and he did one because his in-law, I think it was his uncle or his brother-in-law or something like that, really loved this old car he used to have. So he got, like, pictures of his old car, and what he did is he did this thing where he took his car and he did a little tread mark over the background. With his car, he rolled over it, so it had a little tread mark in the background. It had the keys of his old car in there and everything, and he presented this, and he spent a lot of time on this. And he got a reaction, which he thought he'd get a little bit of a better reaction. And he asked him, like, so what's wrong? And he goes, well, the tread marks are wrong, because the tires on my car wouldn't look like that, right? And I kind of get it, because it's one of those things that will really throw you off. It's because that's all he's going to see when he looks at that thing is what is wrong.
Yeah.
Right? And it's not the same treads that were on his original car.
Yeah.
Right? And I kind of get
those are the details, though. Yeah. I mean, and you know, like, if you're working with material that you're not maybe knowledgeable about, like, it's like... Man, I read a wrestling comic lately. I'm not going to say which story it was or what the story or who wrote it or who drew it. It's not important. What's important is the person who wrote and drew that story, the team that did that story, had no idea what they were doing. They had no idea what story they were telling.
It's not the one
they had no idea what that moment in history in wrestling was actually all about, and they gave us a fictional perspective of two wrestlers who I'm sure were not even consulted in the story. And I remember reading it going, sure, this is so stupid. This is so aggravating.
Was it actual wrestlers? Was it like a biography kind of thing, or was it a...
No, it was I don't know. A comic book retelling of something that happened in the fictional world of comics, but it's a real story, and it just fail anyway.
But then who are they marketing to?
Because I don't know.
All of us who are wrestling fans are gonna know
the details.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's so all out there.
Are they thinking they're gonna get that new reader?
I just don't
know these characters at all, and are gonna.
I just didn't understand it. So I mean, that's you know, that was my take on that kind of like.
Yeah.
I don't know how I think I got sidetracked there. What was the original
thing? Details, attention to detail. You're being a river counter.
Yeah. There was a point I was going to make. I just lost
wrestling.
It. Sorry. Yeah. I don't know what it is. I just had another brain lapse. But
crap.
Attention to detail. Yeah. Anyway, it's a super important thing. I fixate on details. I mean, that's what it's all
job,
about.
Though.
That's what the job is. Like, I don't know, man. If you're working with material that you're not familiar with. Get familiar with it. I did a job recently for a comic book company, and I was given a brief and material to work from, and I didn't do my research. I just worked from the brief, and I worked from the limited amount of material that I was given. And then when I actually went to execute the drawing and ink it and color it, I realized that I had made grievous errors in what the characters actually look like, because I was given what I thought was a limited amount of material, because I didn't think a lot of material existed about this character that I had to draw. I had to draw 6 characters on this one cover. So then I actually went and did my research, and I looked up the characters. I thought, well, maybe there's some fan art or something, so I can get a sense of maybe there's cosplay of these characters, so I can see what the costume looks like from different angles. No, I was wrong. There was no cosplay. There was billions of cosplay. There was tons of fan art. There was tons of published material. These characters all had their own books.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I'd never heard of them. So I was working from what were basically thumbnails that were emailed to me off my phone to draw these characters. And it's kind of heartbreaking to get to spend so much time on a piece and then realize all of it's wrong and know that those core fans are going to go, who the hell is this Ruth asshole?
Right.
And what did he do with my character? And it's just simply because I didn't do my homework. So it's one of those things where, you know, if you're going to research something if you're going to draw or work in a world that you're not familiar with, make sure you have all this stuff so you don't look like an ass. Because now when this cover comes out, I'm going to grimace when I see it. Because I've had to invent things that I just simply didn't have the material. Had I looked for it, I would have found it.
But. Like being a martial artist, you know, when I'm watching an action film,
right.
I appreciate that they take the time to do the choreography correctly.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, you like, even watching wrestling, like going back to watching wrestling, and of course it's predetermined.
Sure,
like
sure. That,
but you appreciate the people that actually understand what I would call the submission wrestling game.
Sure.
As opposed to the TV wrestling game, yep. Right? And there's a lot of wrestlers that would put people in
like
holes.
The shoot wrestling.
That if they were really going to apply pressure, would actually do damage,
sure.
or hurt someone, as opposed to someone that would grab an arm an odd way, and then of course they're selling it, but that would never hurt anybody.
You see,
right?
That's what I loved about the Japanese Japanese wrestling too. Even with the American, even though it was that predetermined stuff. I remember there was a wrestler who's gone now. Gary Albright was his name. He wrestled for the All Japan Wrestling, and he had this tremendous, like a master of some kind of martial arts too. I want to say it was Kenpo, but I don't think that's the right word. It was some kind of real hard style of like throws suplexy kind of like neck drop kind of.
He was a shoe wrestler too.
Yeah, like, and he was a shooter, and he wrestled against Vader, and they had this whole storyline where it was like Gary Albright versus Vader. And the match, they're trading power bombs, they're trading all these big moves, but the match ended when Albright simply got an armbar.
Right.
And it was like there was no drama. It was like, oh, it wasn't like a big two count after a power bomb kick. Yeah. Like, you know, oh, he gave him the power bomb, a 1-2 kick out. No, it was like, oh my God, he's got him in the armbar, and that's the end of the match. Because how do you counter that when you're a 400-pound guy on your face and you're in an armbar? You're done. Like,
when it's fixed in?
When it's fixed in. Exactly. Exactly. Right? And so Vader didn't want to lose his arm, and so he tapped out to Gary Albright. And it made the show, even though it was fictional, seem... Because at any moment, Antonio Inoki could slip you in a cross arm breaker and it's done.
Right.
You know, that's it. So
Jerry Briscoe was one of the toughest guys, too. Like, if you wanted to take someone down, it wasn't a problem for
him. Oh, there was guys who could just take you apart. Just take you. Oh, Meng is one of those dudes who could take
Who's
you
the
apart.
British guy?
William Regal.
Regal.
Regal yes. is a legit... Regal, when Regal was a kid, he was kicking dudes' heads off in... like public wrestling market fair kind of stuff back in Blackpool.
Circus
he was kicking people in the teeth. He was like literally a prize fighter as a kid taking on full grown men in the crowd. That's how he got his cred, man.
They used to do the whole can you last 5 minutes with this guy, and they would do like sort of a wager, and
for sure
he would be the guy. They would send him in, and people were not lasting.
Dave Finley was like that too. There's
Finley,
a couple of those guys
God,
that are just
Finley's
like
he's a monster.
They weren't the you know, the superstar of the of the
I'll tell you though, man, I would have loved to have seen a Finley title run. Because there was a time when Finley was so legit the hardest man in that sport, you know, that people didn't know what to do with him. He was like Benoit. He was like those guys who were just so good. That's why it's amazing to see Nakamura doing as well as he is, because they usually F up Japanese guys when they bring them to WWF. They don't know what to do because the level is just a different... It's just a different level.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a different level.
It's just... That's why I can't watch wrestling now because I feel like the psychology's all gone. I didn't appreciate it as a kid. I just saw them as characters and heels and baby faces. But it was the psychology of it,
right? Yeah, there was storytelling there, man. Yeah. There was real storytelling.
I didn't realize how much storytelling there was happening in a Ric Flair match or a Bret Hart match or what.
Hey, man, when Earthquake attacks Hulk Hogan on Brother Love and he gives him the earthquake on the stage, and Mean Gene Okerlund is legit crying on TV. He's weeping into the microphone. Fans, we don't know what we're going to do. Hogan's down. And he's crying. That shit was real to us, man.
What is happening?
Now it's the high spot era, right? Like I liked watching as a kid, like a teenager, seeing the cruiserweights on WCW do all those like fun, cool looking moves. But watching it as a smarter fan, you're it's a little cheesy.
The mid '90s. Okay, in my opinion, my favorite era of wrestling really is from about 1988. To about 1996, and in that, and I'm not even talking about the Attitude Era because I didn't even get into WWE. I'm talking WCW from about 1988 to about 1996 was off the chain. It was so good. 91, when you had guys like Dr. Death on TV every night, you had these murder back suplexes, you had Terry Gordy, you had the Road Warriors, you had all these super hard badass dudes, you had incredible storytelling, you had Rick Rude as the champ, you had Masahiro Chono as the champ, you had these incredible wrestlers trading that belt and trading those stories, you had the Great Muta, I mean, the great Muda is...
He's awesome.
He's my favorite wrestler in the world not named Randy Savage. Let's just put it that way.
Is that right?
You know,
I was going to ask you, who's your favorite?
Yeah, who's your favorite?
I mean, Savage is probably my favorite in terms of his contribution to the sport, but I mean, I'm always going to have a soft spot for guys like Jim Neidhart, Road Warrior Hawk, you know, Dr. Death Steve Williams. Some of these guys were just icons to me, just gigantic icons. Road Warrior Hawk, I mean... You wouldn't have had a Goldberg without Road Warrior Hawk. You wouldn't have had so many characters that built that mannerism, that physical tick, that thing that Road Warrior Hawk could do that no one could do like him.
Yeah, I was listening to Tony Schiavone talk about the Four Horsemen and when Road Warrior Hawk was in the Road Warriors with Dusty, and how they used to hate when he would come in last, because when he would come in, like when the lights were on, Michael Hegstrand was Hawk.
Yep.
He would really...
Well?
Yeah, he would... He almost took out Tony Schiavone's eye once when he got into the ring. Right. And Schiavone was in the corner with the mic, and he just didn't even see him. He jumped on the thing, he got him in the face, he started bleeding. Schiavone started bleeding from the spikes on the shoulder pads, because he was, like, in such a trance,
right? Well, people hated getting in the ring with a guy. When you're a jobber tag team and you're going out to fight the Road Warriors, you knew one of you was going to go home with a bad headache that day, because that doomsday device was going to... They were going to do it to you. And unless you knew how to land that thing, you were going to die. That move was a nasty, nasty, terrifying thing, but it was the most impressive thing on TV. Yeah, it was incredible. Those guys, and you know, they always talk about who partied the hardest and who, you know, who, like, people talk about Ric Flair being the big partier, and I know that he is, but they say if you really wanted to test your mettle as a man, as a partier, as a drinker, you didn't go drinking with Nature Boy, you went out drinking with Road Warrior Hawk.
Was it him?
Andre. Or you went with guys like Rick Rude and Kurt Hennig together were a terrible duo, man. Those guys... They used to do open-handed slaps and knock men unconscious, like an open-handed slap to the temple and knock someone out in a bar, just because, you know, you're a tough guy, right? And, you know, you're a wrestler, and
they always had to prove
some drunk wants to come up and see how tough you really are. I heard that's all fake. Okay, well, let me give you one slap in the head and see. And he'd knock a full-grown man, 300-pound dude, unconscious with an open-handed slap to the head. Like, just beautiful. You know? I miss those guys, man. You never see guys like that again.
Yeah. It's all choreographed now. Like, you see these guys do these things in the ring, and it's just like, it's cool to watch, but it just looks like a circus act in a lot of ways, more so than ever. Like, before, you would get aggravated watching the heel get out of the ring because he was scared or he was a coward. And you didn't realize that, oh, he's the one who's really making this match work, not the babyface,
right?
The guy who's popular, like a Hulk Hogan. Yeah, he had the in-ring presence.
People, wanted to see Roddy Piper get murdered. Yeah. They wanted to see him die. They wanted to see Bobby Heenan get murdered. That's why they went to the ring.
Piper was one of my favorite wrestlers.
Oh, yeah.
I say Savage, Piper, and Hitman.
Yeah.
What about you, Eric? What do you got?
Well, Hitman would have been number one, but as in-ring performer... I could watch Kurt Angle.
Oh yeah.
Like that guy, like I believe
I would have loved to see I would have loved to have seen Brett and Angle do a match like in their prime.
Yeah.
And you know, Brett, watching Brett go, like watching his career from the beginning, as I had, like, cuz I used to stay up until 3 in the morning to watch Stampede Wrestling, came out at 3:05. I used to watch that, and I watched Brett in those days, and I watched him in the FF or in the WWF, and I watched him I watched WrestleMania 2, that battle royal where Andre eliminates them both at the end, and just watching Brett, even though he left Jim Neidhart way behind, which I've always been a bigger fan of Jim Neidhart than Brett. That's just me. I'm just a Jim Neidhart guy. He was my spirit animal as a kid. but watching Brett's rise, his matches with Mr. Perfect, which began to define him really as a top singles performer, those are some of the best wrestling matches in the world. And his stuff with Roddy Piper, the fact that Piper, the first pinfall Piper received in his career, in his recorded career anyway, was against Bret Hart in WrestleMania. That was a big deal.
Lot of his great matches were ones that he even lost. Like,
oh, for sure. His match against Randy Savage at Saturday night's main event, the formation of the Mega Powers. It was Savage and Bret Hart, and Bret is tearing Savage apart. Savage is selling a bad ankle the whole match, selling it hard, and Bret is killing the ankle. Bret is making my dad's... I remember as a kid, my dad going, holy shit, watching Bret just wring Savage's ankle with the boot off, his bare socked foot, wringing it off the ring post. And I think my dad made some comments like, "Jesus, I just felt my nuts curl up into my body watching that." You know what I mean? And just watching those kind of matches with Brett. I mean, and Ben Savage beats him with a small package in the center of the ring, like a reverse body slam. Like, but that match was just so fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, just the pinnacle of those two guys. And then later, when Brett was the champ, they fought in the UK. If you ever want to see a really cool match, look up Brett Savage in the UK. And Savage comes down and Brett catches him and puts him in the sharpshooter, and Savage taps. I don't want to spoil the end, he taps to the sharpshooter, but it's when Brett is the champ. And Savage is on his twilight years in the WWE. Yep. He still had the NWO yet to come, but this is towards the end. It's probably like whenever Brett was champ, so like 92-ish in that era.
The first run? The first time?
Yeah, it was the first or second, but it was Brett in the UK with Randy Savage, and that is some beautiful stuff, man. Beautiful.
I still think the Stone Cold match is one of my favorite matches of all time.
Incredible. Incredible.
Blood from Stone, just because of the...
They changed his style.
Do you mean the Ringmaster one where they fought the first time and Brett beats him literally the same way he beats Roddy Piper?
Right,
it's the Million Dollar Dream instead of a sleeper hold. Still a great end to a match, though. You know,
when it's basically the turning point for Austin when he became the heel to the face turn, and then Brett became the heel during that same match.
I was a giant Steve Austin guy in WCW before he came over. Like, I loved that he came over. I thought the Ringmaster gimmick was silly, but I knew that it was going to be whatever it was. I knew it was going to change into something else. But like the Hollywood Blonde stuff that he did, like his tag team matches against his matches, singles matches, first of all, against his TV title matches against Rick Steamboat and WCW. Again, it's from that era I'm talking about, where that wrestling in WCW is just so good. It's just so at the top, you know?
Yeah, they
incredible.
Because they didn't base a lot of their characters as much on the size
they were built on house shows. They were taping house shows. They had to make the crowd was legit responses. They were small venues, but they made it look like big shows, and it was beautiful stuff. Man, they had to tell. Used to be a time in WCW, NWA back in the day when a tag team was the big draw. A tag team would always be the main event, and there'd be a tag team match that would go with a 60-minute draw, and people would expect that the next night too. And these guys would perform the next night too. That's Rock crazy. And Roll Express and Midnight Express, 60-minute draw, you know, like crazy long match, or best of three falls matches that last an hour and a half, like stuff like that. It's just people don't have the patience for it anymore. But that was some real storytelling in those days.
When you watch like 60-minute match between Brett and Shawn, I watched it the first time, and I'm like, it didn't really feel like an hour. I was really engaged.
No. They filled that whole hour, man.
Even though there was lots of spots where they were, you know, had each other in a hold, but you knew, like, who's going to tap first.
Oh, yeah.
They're wearing each other down. They're telling the story.
And that's the way you tell an Iron Man story. You have one fall. You tell that 60-minute match, and then you have an overtime one fall end.
That was Rick Flair special,
was beautiful.
Right?
Yeah. Then they do what? They do an Iron Man match years later between... What was that one that they did that was so stupid?
Was it Rock and...
No, I'm thinking of the so-called submission Iron Man match where they had Benoit and Angle. The match went something like 8 falls to 7. Like, it was ridiculous. And it was so much of it. It was called a submission match, but like a bunch of the matches ended by German suplex. They ended by pinfall. And I was like, this is a submission match, guys.
It's a submission.
And like, and it was really weird. Like, you'd have, like, Angle would get into a submission match and he would tap instantly. And the strategy behind that being, well, I don't want to injure this arm by resisting tapping out. That's the story they're trying to tell. But it ended up being this astronomical score of like 8-7 or something by the end of the match.
Yeah.
But like, you think about that Iron Man
match. They don't mean anything.
That Iron Man match when it goes to 60 minutes and then Gorilla Monsoon has to come out and make it go another. Okay, we're going to go until this thing ends. Like,
well, everybody thought, you know, that he beautiful. Was legit, right? When Brett went backstage. He was really mad. He's like, I was trying to sell it for the
yeah,
you know, the
tell
return.
That story, man.
I wanted to tell a story. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you know, those are the type of things you don't appreciate. You don't see it no more. It's too... once that curtain's pulled back in wrestling, it's just like...
The only thing that stands out in that match that I hated is when Shawn finally gets the pinfall and hits him with that kick, and he lays on top of him, and Brett folds up for the count, and it's the slowest... agonizing 3 count you've ever seen. It wasn't like Brett nearly kicked out. No. He just laid there like a dead man and took the slowest 3 count I've ever seen in my life. It made me sick. I was like, come on.
What?
It should have been so close, you know?
Right?
But
that's the thing.
Instead, it was just clear knockout, like Brett is done. And we were like, we all got it. That was a story. Right. That was the passing of the torch at the time or whatever. But I'm not a Shawn Michaels guy, so that's...
I want to ask that question. What's with the... I feel like... that whole era where Brett got kind of pushed aside out of WWF at the time, I don't think Shawn Michaels was as much of a franchise guy in regards to what he brought to, like, he was a great performer.
Mm-hmm.
What he could do in the ring was incredible. But for him, for Brett to be pushed out and that guy to get all of the, what was going on backstage for them to have that preferential treatment?
It just comes down to Vince in those days, yeah. I think,
that's what,
man.
I mean.
It comes down
to
Vince. And, you know, Brett, for all of the great things Brett brought to the ring, he didn't have the kind of easy charm and style and grace that Shawn had with the fans. Brett could talk, but Brett couldn't talk like Shawn. And he couldn't be smooth like Shawn in that way. Brett was very clear and very good. I'm not taking anything away from the Hitman. He is, you know, he is what he says he is.
Yeah.
But when it came down to it, for that era, I think Shawn was just an easier person to cheer
speak
for.
On the, yeah.
And maybe it just was a broader audience. I think Brett appealed to the guys who loved wrestling. And I think Shawn Michaels appeared to people who liked hair metal and people who liked, I don't know, people who like that kind of sexy 90s thing.
Do you think he brought in maybe some more female viewers?
Definitely brought in more female viewers.
Like, maybe that's
definitely
what they're looking for,
like Bret Hart too, though.
Yeah, they did. They
the
did.
Thing that I'm, like, I didn't think Shawn Michaels was that much of a great, like, he was a little bit obnoxious when he would talk. And not because he was a heel. It was just, even when he was trying to be a babyface, like, his voice after a while got very irritating. But
I couldn't stand Shawn Michaels until he made his return after his back injury. He took those 4 years off and came back. Then I actually appreciated him. And then, you know, when you see him win the world title at that stage of his career, and it was a great match too.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, okay, I can dig it. You know, I get it now, Shawn. And his matches with The Undertaker speak for themselves. Those WrestleMania matches, these were, if Undertaker had lost to Michaels in the second one, I would not have been disappointed. That would have been a fine ending. But I love that he didn't. I love that Taker. I hate what has happened to Taker.
Mm.
I hate what has happened to that streak legacy. But those matches with Triple H, those matches with Shawn,
the matches, make him lose at WrestleMania.
That made no sense. If you wanted to have him lose, having him lose to Brock is what Undertaker wanted, and he should ultimately be the guy who decides. But the problem with the Brock Lesnar win, it was 4 years ago, and there's been three WrestleManias since, or four since, and Taker's had, you know, he beat Bray and he beat whatever, but like, losing to Roman Reigns was tragic. Losing to Brock Lesnar made sense if it was the end of the Taker's run.
Yeah, that's it. That's how you end it.
You end it this year. So you have Taker, you have a title match. You have it actually put some real stakes on it. Have Brock Lesnar not only end the streak, but have him win the belt off the Taker, because that all of a sudden, and then if they had just had him do that, if they had just had him end the streak, and then actually put the belt on him and actually had him be this monster world champion for like 3 years. Like, why not have the monster world champ? Like, we had that growing up. We had Hulk Hogan. He had that belt for 3 years. Then he won it back, lost it, won it back, lost it, won it back, lost it. But it didn't matter.
That's
for an era.
That's the problem, though.
You just don't. You had Bruno Sammartino had that belt for 8 years.
I agree.
That's incredible.
Yeah. But the problem is, once they watered down the product and they had a Raw and a SmackDown and then they had the WCW brand extension and all those belts, the belts meant nothing.
Oh, the belts mean nothing now.
That's the trouble.
The belts
meant nothing. So you had, like, The Rock become. I like The Rock. I was a big fan of him during that time. But he became a 7-time champion in a matter of 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a pay-per-view every month, right?
Yeah.
So the stakes, they just didn't mean anything
The belt was constantly changing.
Every month,
there's
a new champ. It's just like, let somebody have a run. So when that guy gets beat, it means something.
Yeah.
It's big. Like when Triple H finally won at WrestleMania against Chris Jericho in Toronto.
Yeah.
That was... For what was a pretty decent WrestleMania, that was a very lackluster end.
Oh, yeah. First of all, the end that should have been Hogan and Rock.
Right.
Exactly. Nothing. I mean, there was great matches that whole show. I was there.
Yeah,
there was great matches that whole show, but nothing can stop the power of that match. That was emotional. That was a life-changing thing for a lot of people. And you can't follow up a match like that. You can't. They followed it up with a ladies tag match, and then nothing wrong with that. But that's not how you follow that match.
No.
You know, and then you have the title match with Jericho. And the problem is that was the thing that I always, that's my one beef with the whole Jericho thing, is like, Jericho was the champion we were waiting for. Jericho is still the most entertaining person in television, as far as I'm concerned. Jericho, when he defeated The Rock, defeated The Rock in Austin on the same night to become the Universal Champ, He did, and it's too bad that those matches were steeped with, like, run-ins and interference and ridiculous, like, eight stunners and rock bottoms, and it was all just a big schmoz, and ultimately Jericho ended up with the belt that night. But you had the young blonde lion champion in Jericho with the two belts, and then the next day they basically turned him into a heel. And then he had Stephanie as his manager. And all that beautiful heat that him and Stephanie had when he was feuding with Triple H was gone. And he was calling her awful, nasty things, which made such great television. And now he's his manager against her own husband. That story just went off the rails. And you could have had this great... I mean, haven't you always wanted to be player one? Haven't you always wanted to be that wrestling player one where you go through and you beat all the wrestlers and then you beat the champ wrestler, then you defend your belt, just like NES Pro Wrestling or any arcade generic wrestling game you played? Chris Jericho is player one. Chris Jericho is... When you look at the original like wrestling arcade game, Mat Mania, where you're player one and you fight the Insane Warrior, and then after that you fight the Karate Fighter, and after that you fight the Coco Savage. I don't know if you know the game, but it's a really old wrestling game.
No, I remember,
But that game was designed around Dynamite Kid. Player one's Dynamite Kid, because Dynamite Kid was the hottest thing in wrestling at the time. Jericho was the champion that we deserved to have, who should have been the hero face champion to carry that belt for about 3 years.
Yeah, people take
and have and have everyone yeah, have guys yeah. like Austin go heel and go after him and not succeed. Have The Rock go heel and not succeed. Have monsters come back like Vader and all these big guys come back and have them Jericho triumph over, because we had that Hulk Hogan, we had that iconic, and people hated it at the time. The smart wrestling fans in the time hated Hulk Hogan because of what he represented. He represents what Roman Reigns represents so many of us now. But at the time, I hated Hulk Hogan because I was a Randy Savage guy. But I got goosebumps every time Hogan came to the ring.
Yeah.
I got goosebumps every time he ran down to save one of my dudes getting beat up.
Yeah.
Hogan was always involved in those crucial character turns.
He was important.
And when he was there to reverse, when the formation of the mega powers I still get goosebumps. Look at that. Just thinking about it. Because of that, that was a big deal, man.
I can confirm he got goosebumps.
But, you know, like, that was a big deal. And that's like... I don't know. I'm probably losing track of what I'm talking about.
No, they had to hold the story patiently. It's like a comic book story, right? Like, let the story be told. Know when, how long it's going to be. Know where you're going with it. And try to stick that landing. Don't go too many more issues. Don't try to tell the story too short. Like, they set up from WrestleMania 4 that it would be WrestleMania 5, Hogan and Macho.
Sure.
And they, from the time that they first teamed up, or they would show clips where they would say, Hogan, just subtly look at Miss Elizabeth. And that was the story they told.
It was beautiful, man.
It was so subtle.
The promos that Savage Cat cut leading up to WrestleMania, when he actually spliced all those moments together.
Yeah,
but we've all been along for that ride.
Exactly.
We've all been along for... We've all become sick with hatred in the same way that Randy Savage became sick with hatred.
It was masterful.
I remember watching Savage with his glasses off cut that last promo before WrestleMania 5. And he's almost green. He's so fucking angry at Hulk Hogan. He's telling it so well. Mm-hmm. And we as fans had no idea the legit heat that was actually happening at the time. But we're at home watching this going, and I remember being a kid, I suffered from migraine headaches. I used to get nauseous with them. And I remember being on the couch in my parents' basement, sick with a headache, watching Randy Savage, who was green with anger and rage on the screen. And he was talking about Hulk Hogan and his words were coming out all broken. And it was just so... fucking magnificent listening to him go on with this story, because to him it was so real. And then he put that spool, that little spool of moments where he's like, I watched you looking at Elizabeth and all that stuff was happening. And you're like, you fucking got him there, man. We're watching it too.
Yeah, you touched her.
We're watching it
too.
He steadies her. He steadies her, but of course,
remember that slow-mo.
Oh, for sure. That's great. For sure.
Oh, my God.
Beautiful stuff, though.
It really was.
Yeah, they don't. They stopped doing that after, like...
The five elbows.
Oh, my God.
Five elbows.
Is that how much you gave him in that
five
match?
Five elbows.
Yeah. No, you're thinking about the Warrior. That's the Warrior match. The Warrior retirement match.
And that was Warrior.
He only gives Hogan the one elbow when Hogan kicks it.
When he wrestled Hogan at five, he almost couldn't do it because he had a staph infection in his arm. His arm was wrapped up that way because they're like, you shouldn't even be going out
there. And there was that. And there was one beautiful thing in that match, too, that was unplanned. Early in the match, Hogan sends Savage into the ropes for back body drop, drops his head, and Savage kicks him and opens up his eyebrow with a boot, and you actually see the boot just scrape his eyebrow almost right off, and Hogan's head's bleeding from that point on in the match.
Sweet,
but it's like
the
hard way. Yeah, they misjudged that one, that reversal. Man. But it's beautiful. It just makes for such a great story. Like,
do you take anything away from Savage because he was so scripted? Like, he had to practice his matches to a T. He was so detail-oriented, yeah. Whereas other guys can go in there and do it on the fly and still tell something.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, like, everyone's got their own method, right? I mean, it's like any artist, I think. I know there's people out there that take shortcuts to get finished drawings, and all those people out there who build everything from bare bones. I know there's people who need to have a studio of 500 musicians behind them to make their album sound good, and there's other guys who can play a banjo with four strings on a street corner and then change the world. So I think you're looking at process there. You're looking at an artist's process, and I think if Savage had a vision and he thought he could tell a story, and there's few who could tell a story like he could.
Yeah.
I think if you trusted in that vision, I think that you'd probably end up with a great match. But there was a lot of guys who just said, okay, whatever. Like, you look at guys like George Steele would always tell the story about how Savage would write these like 18-page scripts of how he wanted a match to go,
really?
Or how he wanted the story arc to go.
He was like that.
And I remember there's a story where George Steele actually ate the script. He actually just started tearing pages and eating them. And it, because he thought it was ridiculous. He's like, let's just go, you know, we know you're going to win, or we know that I'm going to win, or it's going to go this way. But as long as these moments happen, then the script is meaningless. But yeah. I think for the people that stuck to it, they probably told some of the best Randy Savage stories. Like,
Steamboat said, he's like, it was a little too detailed for what I was used to, because I worked with Ric Flair.
But he said
at the end, he goes, there's nothing, I've never had a match like that.
Yeah.
At the end of it all.
Steamboat was another one I really loved.
Oh, Steamboat was great, man.
He was really good.
And, you know, everyone talks about the Chi-Town Rumble with him and Ric Flair and stuff, and the great best of three falls matches and the times they traded the belt. And they are unbelievable matches. But those guys wrestled each other 1,000 times. And it was those house shows that you weren't at, those house shows that weren't on TV, that no one saw, that were probably the best matches. But, you know, a guy like Ricky Steamboat, guys like Steamboat and Flair, they don't need a script. And Savage didn't need a script either, but he felt he did, because he had a specific story he wanted to tell, I guess. But he told great stories. I mean, WrestleMania 3, he's got Steamboat pinned. Flying elbow, dead center of the ring. He's got his leg hooked. And I remember as a kid, I watched that match 1,000 times. And I would count to 17. He had a 17 count on Ricky Steamboat. And I was so angry, you know?
No one could do a skin the cat.
But
like
look
Ricky
at how
Steamboat.
Beautiful that match is. Savage is going off the top rope with the bell. He's going to finish Steamboat forever. He's going to finish him forever now. He's got the steel belt. And we've already told the story when he injured his throat with the steel belt.
Oh,
and
yes.
Savage has come back. And Steamboat's come back to WrestleMania. This is his vengeance. And there we are. Savage has already beaten him. Already had him beat. The referee was knocked out. Now Savage is going to finish him for real with the belt. And we're all going, he's going to legit finish off Ricky Steamboat. And then George Steele comes and dumps Savage. But not only does Savage get dumped off the top rope, when he falls, he drops the bell. And the bell bounces and hits Savage in the head. So now you have this little tiny detail, which adds a whole other dimension, because there's Savage staggered from a steel bell to the head. He goes to do a scoop slam on Ricky Steamboat, and we have an inside cradle and a beautiful end to a beautiful match.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that's WrestleMania. That's still that was the main event of WrestleMania 3, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that was great.
I don't think anything has really.
Do you remember the Trials of the Dragon?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
In the height
of
the ninja
really
craze.
There was some really cheesy, bad, racist television
goodness.
On those, but it was good stuff too.
It was Ricky Steamboat.
You know what I've been loving?
Ninjas.
My thing lately is I've been watching not podcasts. I've been watching shoot interviews with old wrestlers.
Oh, yeah, okay. I love those.
And I was watching a bunch with King Kong Bundy the other day, and I was never a huge Bundy guy. But man, he's got some shit to say about some wrestlers, man. Like, he hated Randy Savage. He hated Savage's whole family. I guess it's all because Savage made some comment about his weight, and I guess Savage's old man, Angelo, said something like, oh, well, don't worry, King Kong's not going to be around much longer. Look at the shape he's in, kind of thing. And and then, you know, King Kong legit turns to the camera and goes, well, you're both dead, and I'm still here, motherfuckers. Kind of makes some comment like that. But he was talking about,
he's a little bit bitter, though.
Really?
Oh, sure.
Well, he's
talking, too, about how, you know, you have, what was it, like, I guess Andre the Giant never gave him any respect. Like, never gave him any respect.
Andre didn't like other big guys.
But in those days, you know, before Hulk Hogan slammed Andre the Giant at WrestleMania 3, everyone slammed Andre the Giant. Bundy slammed Andre the Giant numerous times in their matches. But it was never a big deal. When Hogan slammed Andre, it was a giant deal. But like little Ricky Choshu in Japan, 5'6", 245 pounds, slammed Andre the Giant, 1984. It's beautiful. He just picks up this. Andre's wearing yellow trunks and yellow boots, and there's Ricky Choshu, all 5'6" of him. Runs up and picks up Andre like nothing. Picks him up like a sack of shit and slam. Walks, takes three steps and throws him. It wasn't like a hip toss slam like right. Hogan gives him at WrestleMania 3. This is a little Japanese dude who picks up Andre and takes three steps and body slams him. It's gorgeous. And you look at these old matches too with like Harley Race. Harley Race, I think, was the first guy to slam Andre the Giant. Not as King Harley Race, not in Vince McMahon's cartoon world, but like in the day. Like there's photographs from old magazines of Harley Race with 375-pound Andre in those days, picked him up and walked across the ring with him like he was carrying like a sack of potatoes. Unbelievable. So yeah, it's just funny, you know. People talk about the body slam and the leg drop and all that kind of stuff, but Hogan made it look good, man. That leg drop looked good to me. I don't care. Say what you want. I was never a Hulk Hogan guy, but
I think he was very important.
He made wrestling accessible to everybody.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Big time.
You know.
And yeah.
My first experience with him was actually Rocky III. It was the first time I ever saw Hulk Hogan. But
Thunderlips.
Yeah. And if you watch that match, he murders.
Oh yeah.
He murders. He does power slams and suplexes. Does moves that Hulk Hogan never did in the ring in real life.
You're right. Yeah.
But he murders Sly Stallone with that shit, man. It's beautiful.
Doesn't he do like a small package or something? Like,
He gives him a power slam that's just gorgeous. Like I've never seen such a good power. Like it was like a, you know, it was amazing. Yeah. It was like a, yeah.
Only thing is, you don't know how many takes, moves like that, how many takes he had to do it, but.
I think he could do it.
It looked great.
Yeah, I think.
Oh yeah.
And he's such a huge man compared to like, because everyone, you know, you look at Rocky and you think, oh, he's a pretty big 6 foot dude. No, like Sly's a little dude. Like he's a little dude, and to have him go up against like a 6'7" Hulk Hogan, you know, 300-pound Hulk Hogan, like that was. It looked good. It made for great, you know, great TV.
What are your top five WrestleMania matches?
Oh, that's tough. Top five WrestleMania matches. Let's see. Well, definitely Savage and Savage and Steamboat is huge for me. That's really a good question. I think I have to look at WrestleMania 4 as an entirety of Savage. Like the night that Savage won the belt was a pretty big deal for me. All those matches were pretty good for what they were. But he wrestled four times in one night to win the belt. That's pretty fucking awesome.
Was Hell in a Cell WrestleMania?
I'm not sure. Triple H in
the original, the first one.
No.
Was that? Oh, that wasn't okay.
No, WrestleMania matches. That's interesting. That's really good. I really liked the Ric Flair and Shawn Michaels match. The one that ended Flair's career. I did like it. But I'll have to say, one of the best WrestleMania matches I ever saw was also at WrestleMania 18, and it was Undertaker Ric Flair. Because Arn Anderson showed up in that match with the crowbar, and there was all kinds of, like, for a moment there, I thought Flair was going to beat The Undertaker. I thought that was going to be pretty rad. Other matches at WrestleMania, shite. There's some good stuff, man. Really good stuff. I don't know if I can answer that. I don't know if I can, picking five, because, like, WrestleMania 3, I watched so many times, like, Hercules versus Billy Jack Haynes is a wicked match from WrestleMania 3. I love that match. Hercules Hernandez is gone now too. Yeah, I think probably Brett and Roddy was a pretty big one for me too. I loved Owen Hart's debut at WrestleMania 5 when he lost to Mr. Perfect to the Perfect Plex. Yeah. That was a beautiful match. Just a beautiful, beautiful match. Yeah, man. There's some really good stuff. Jake Roberts and Honky Tonk Man was actually pretty good at WrestleMania 3. I think that's really...
No, it was fun. Jake Roberts versus Rick Martel.
That was good. And again, that was good storytelling. When you see when you finally have the interview with Jake and he takes the glasses off and the eyes get the white contacts in. Right. It was so great, man. That was beautiful. But Rick Martel, talk about a fine athlete. Talk about an incredible wrestler.
Yeah.
Talk about a guy that never got the credit he deserved. That guy was a top level performer.
Oh, yeah.
And if you look at those early Royal Rumbles, the early Royal Rumble matches, Martel would go into those matches early. He would be one of the longest lasting guys in those matches in those days. It was incredible. Him, guys like him and guys like Greg Valentine, they could go in those matches and just stand there and take a beating for an hour before they were thrown out. Like, just incredible stuff.
Bret Hart, Owen Hart.
Bret Hart, Owen Hart is really hard to beat. That's one that I often forget about too, because I wasn't watching wrestling as closely around 94, 95. And those
opened the show too.
And Owen wins, and
beats him clean. It's beautiful.
And that, see, that's the thing with, as when I became a big Bret Hart fan, was when he lost to British Bulldog.
Oh yeah,
like he. There's a thing about a guy.
He had to carry Bulldog the entire match. Watched that match. The guy's out of gas the whole time.
Right.
Unbelievable.
That's what I mean. So he made a lot of these guys. Like, he didn't need to make Owen look good, but the
Owen's great though. Owen's
amazing. Fantastic. Brett even said Owen's he was a better good. Wrestler than he
yeah.
was. Right?
Oh yeah. So, oh yeah. Owen was the talent in that family. If you watch those old, like,
Brett's his biggest fan.
When Owen was the champ at Stampede. And he was wrestling guys like John Tenta and some of these gigantic dudes, like, and then Bad News Allen.
Oh, yeah.
Again, a legit tough guy. Yeah. A guy that Andre the Giant is legit scared of, you know?
But even as the Blue Blazer, some of those matches were...
Dude, the Blue Blazer opened up my mind when I was a kid. Like, seeing a masked wrestler who looked so good.
Yeah.
And I mean, that first... And the thing that bummed me out was, I remember the first time he showed up on TV, he beats a guy with a moonsault. And I was like, what the fuck? Yeah. And then after that, he would beat guys with a flying body press. It was always kind of like a standing flying body press into a pin. But that first moonsault, he friggin' crushes a guy. But one of my favorite Owen Hart matches, oh, it's so good. I've found it a few times and posted it on my Facebook, because I think people should watch this match. It's from Saturday Night Main Event, and it was Ted DiBiase versus Blue Blazer. Fucking unreal. Just an unreal match. And, you know, Owen loses, but he takes a power. He takes that, to this day, I think the best power slam in wrestling was DiBiase's, like, throw to the rope, Irish whip power slam combo. Mm. It was just fluid. It was just poetry in motion.
Yeah.
Just poetry in motion. And he beats Owen with that move, reversing a high cross body from Owen. But Owen gets injured in that move. You actually see Owen go down, and he tears his inner groin, and you see him rolled out of the ring in favor of the groin. Well, DiBiase's getting the accolades from the win. But the match is unbelievable. And the knife-edge chops that Owen would throw were the meatiest sounded. Like, you like the Ric Flair chop, that's cool, but Owen would throw those European uppercuts, and you would hear the impact of that meat of his arm hitting you into the chin, and you'd just think, how are these guys' heads still on their bodies?
Time in the dungeon.
They had great selling punches, man.
I tell you, you want to see a fucking awesome Owen Hart match. I don't even know how they worked this into the story. I don't think it was ever on TV, because they did this tag team match where the Steiners had just showed up into WWE, and they'd been there for a little while, and they were kicking everyone's ass. And there was some kind of house show that they recorded for one of those VHS releases that they used to, WWE would once in a while do a special VHS release in the 90s. And this was literally during a time when Bret and Owen were feuding. And in this one night, Bret calls out he needs a tag team partner because the Steiners have gotten in Bret's face for some reason. And Bret calls out a tag team partner. He calls out Owen Hart. And it's the Hart brothers versus the Steiner brothers. And if you look up on YouTube, the Hart brothers versus the Steiner brothers, you will see a match that will bend your mind. And there is a point in that match when Scott Steiner, delivers what is to this day the most devastating move I've ever seen in my life. The Steiner screwdriver. If you've never seen it, it's a lift up into a vertical suplex,
and he drops,
but then he spins you and does a jumping pile driver.
Wow.
And he will drop guys right on their necks. He does one to Owen in this match. And Owen takes that move. Like, I've never seen anyone take a pile driver, and he lays there, and I think there's a moment when he is legit dead. Because everyone just kind of stops, and like, because Owen takes that move, and even Bret kind of leans out going, wah, like, no expression, because Owen just... And eventually Owen gets up and makes the tag to Bret, but that move was terrifying. Like, I'm sure Vince, had a
Steiner
stroke.
Steiner driver.
Oh, my God, what a move. The Steiner screwdriver, what a move. And Dynamite Kid used that move as well. I think he actually invented the move. But
that was a guy who I feel... Man, if he would have wrestled... Imagine him and Bret in a title match. At a WrestleMania.
Watch their old matches. There's tons of them, man.
No, I know.
82, 83, like Bret versus Dynamite.
He said
he
loved wrestling.
Just incredible.
Changed his career.
Yeah. And you watch those Tiger Mask versus Dynamite matches too. They will change your life. They are incredible. They're what basically every video game you've ever played about wrestling was based off of. Those guys did things in that. Like, everyone talks about, well, I shouldn't say that. I don't want to take anything away from Rey Mysterio, because Rey Mysterio was fantastic. But everyone talks about, like, the 316, what an innovative thing. Tiger Mask was doing that in 1980. Like, there's tapes of
oh, Super Tiger. Yeah,
there was the cartoon Super Tiger, but I think Tiger Mask is, like, there's been four or five Tiger Masks, yeah, but the original one, Sayama,
is... There's a shoot wrestler that was Super Tiger as
well, yeah. Yeah, no, there's a great legacy with the Tiger Mask stuff, for sure. Plus, he's a muscle wrestling character, I think, or something like that, the Muscle Wrestling League, so... No, that's, yeah, I can talk about wrestling all day, guys. Bloody day.
Well, there you have it, folks. Another one for the books. How much fun was that? Come on. Isn't Mike the best? Like, you could just talk to him forever about everything. Once again, we want to thank Mike Ruth for hanging out with us and just being a buddy of the show. We can't wait to have him on again. And if you are going to Fan Expo, like we said in the intro, make sure you go and visit Mike Ruth. You're going to see Martin Slam Duncan and myself, Eric Anthony, there. We're going to be sporting t-shirts with our podcast logos on it. If you see us and you recognize us, come up to us, say hello. We'd love to meet the fans who listen to the show. Make sure you leave an iTunes review for both of our shows on iTunes. And you can email the Cave of Solitude at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. Give us some listener feedback. Tell us what you think. We love hearing from the fans. Thanks for listening to The Cave of Solitude. I'm Eric Anthony, and we will talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.